Hello, my name is John Barry. You are listening to Type Radio. Now we're talking.
Type Radio.
Just my type.
How did you get involved in UNLC magazine?
Sideways, like everything else. I was in New York for... I've forgotten now what it was. I think it was a TDC conference. Anyway, I had decided I was interested in what was currently being done in ID magazine, and I thought, well, I should get in touch with them, see about writing for them. So I did. I made an appointment to drop by there and met Peter Hall and somebody I can't remember who wasn't there that long. But it was when I got to know Peter. I don't think I ended up writing anything for ID at that point, though I have since. But Peter introduced me to Margaret Richardson, who was editing UNLC. And she was very interested at that moment in finding somebody to do writing write-ups of the new typefaces. So I started doing that for her. So it was this sort of connection by accident. And then it wasn't that much longer, you know, the next year that they decided to, they wanted a new editor and actually had asked Peter first. He didn't want to edit anymore. He wanted to write. He suggested me. So Mark Batty called me up and flew me to New York just before Christmas, and we talked, and it all seemed good. And that's so I started doing it. So I went from... I actually remember going through my own old copies of UNLC. I remember when they started charging for it, and I stopped getting it. I didn't bother subscribing. And I didn't realize, off in Seattle getting my own copies, that you really could have stayed on the list by just filling out a form. So that was very interesting when I was actually at UNLC. I remembered what it was like from the other side, that things that seem obvious to the publisher are not obvious to the reader. Anyway, that actually was a... I know now was an effort on the part of the company to cut down on the mailing list to make it smaller, and it succeeded.
I was surprised because I was like, I had like a subscription, and I got like this design student from Amsterdam, this getting this magazine from the United States with all these like world famous typefaces, and you get it for free. I was like, it's like amazing.
Well, it was a great marketing tool. It was started because it was actually easier and cheaper to start a magazine and give it away for free than it was to conduct a large advertising campaign and keep buying ads everywhere. And it just became an object that everyone wanted anyway. And it was, you know, it was printed cheaply. It was on newsprint. But still, it was expensive. I mean, it's a publication. Mm-hmm. At its height, I think
it had
200,000 readers. And it's amazing how many people have kept them. How many stacks of yellowing copies there are in the back room somewhere.
Sometimes a little eaten by the mice.
Yep. That's probably why the book I edited about UNLC is the most popular one that I've done, because everyone goes, oh, yeah, I remember that, and I need this book. Well, naturally, I encourage this.
Of course you need them. Is there something you absolutely hate about typography?
Bad typography? Careless typography. I could go on for hours about that, but I'm trying to think of anything particularly relevant. I think most of it falls under the category of typography done by people who don't read or don't care about the text. To me, it's all about the text.
And you can see that?
I can see that? Yes, certainly. Designing a page where you have art illustrations or some kind of images butting into the text box, I think that's profoundly disrespectful of the text and therefore of the reader. It's done all the time. But I'm talking about running text here, obviously, which is not the only kind of text. In fact, that's what I just gave a talk about, is the stuff that's not. But in running text, you find a comfortable line length to go with the typeface you're using, the leading, the tracking and everything. You find one that's comfortable and works for that writer's work, and then you stick with that. If you change it in order to have boxes coming in or headlines butting in or pull quotes butting in, then you're saying that those are more important than the text. And you can, of course, very carefully play with the text to wrap around something and make it all work beautifully. But that's rare. Most of the time, you end up with things that look like badly spaced newspaper columns down the side of a piece of art. And that's not easy to read. I'd rather be able to read and have any images be in a separate part of the grid, essentially, a separate column, or not make the text column, whether it's one or four, changing its width for artistic, for visual reasons. It is easier to do that if the text is ragged right than it is if it's justified, but still, it's fundamentally disrespectful of the text. Now, taking that approach that I have and applying it to books where the text and the words interact in complex ways, it gets very interesting. And that's something I love doing, and I'm still exploring ways of doing it. Conceptually, I've always liked what has been done in Dorling Kindersley books, which are melding the text and the images together. In fact, however, they never use the right typefaces or use them right. So they typographically don't live up to their visual design, and I think that hurts them. Mm-hmm. At least it does to me as a reader.
Do you also like those illustrated guides that... Actually, no,
for two reasons. No, for what I just said, but yeah. No, because they're printed on very slick, heavy paper, and a guidebook should not be heavy. I like the rough guides. Actually, a few years ago, I think they've screwed up in the most recent designs, but they not only look good, but they're light and small. That's what you want in a guidebook. There's no point to a guidebook that weighs a couple of kilos. That's useless.
Yeah, but they're very, very popular.
I know they are.
So
I would happily look at one before I leave, but I wouldn't take it with me.
So what do you think about David Carson's work when he came out in the 80s and the 90s with his views on legibility?
I found it fascinating because I remember seeing Beach Culture, and it was fascinating to see, because it was quite deliberate. That was what it was interesting. He obviously knew what he was doing. I thought most of what he was doing was a terrible mistake, but it was still interesting to see. It wasn't done sloppily or by chance.
It didn't have the carelessness that you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, exactly. I suppose that's the good part. The bad part is he had no respect for the text whatsoever. Mm. And so ultimately I thought it was a very... Most of it was a bad thing to do. But I don't go into a rant about, oh, it was crap, oh, he's terrible, oh, he didn't know what he was doing. No, he knew exactly what he was doing. And that's interesting. I have a high tolerance for people who do outrageous things but do them interestingly.
And also, it was, you could see it as a way to start a discussion about legibility and that, and also turning magazine layout into an art form with my... That's cool.
Yes, except to me the discussion is very short. It's like, well, does this do something new and interesting, and does it work? No. So enough. But it is. I mean, I'm being flip, but it is a serious question, and I just think that the answer is no. Very, very rarely. And what he was designing, actually, looking at the magazines he designed, made me realize that something I hadn't realized as an inveterate reader is that most magazines today are not designed to be read. They're designed to be flipped through. So once I realized that, I thought, okay, that really is a different perspective and a different design brief, essentially. Of course, if I were a writer for one of those magazines, I would want to write with that in mind, too. I wouldn't want to write a continuous article that needed to be read properly and then have it designed by David Carson in 1987. No.
But it was appropriate for the magazines he was designing.
Probably was. I don't think the content of Beach Culture really mattered.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you probably wouldn't be reading it. You'd look at the picture.
And also, like, his reply would be that the audience that the article was intended for, mm-hmm. they managed to read it no matter what. They managed to read it anyway.
Some of them did. I don't know how much that's true. But I also, what did they get out of it? That's interesting. It would be interesting to talk to Mario about that, since he has designed surf magazines here in Portugal. And I remember his telling me how, when he designed a typeface for the magazine, that they didn't want a serif. They didn't want a serif typeface. The readers of that magazine found it off-putting to be reading a serif typeface, which is an interesting turnaround from what you expect. Of course, the sans serif that he designed for it, I think, was Stella. It's, of course, very readable. But that again, gives you a way of realizing that your assumptions aren't always right, and you need to examine them again and again.
But do you ever think the other way around? Like, for example, what a beautiful design and such a shame about the content.
Oh, yes, all the time.
Yeah. And so that, you think that's a responsibility that, as a designer, you would say, I would not do this because the content is absolutely rubbish?
That depends. Sometimes you can do that, sometimes you can't. I mean, I try to choose clients that are doing worthwhile things, but there are times when you take a job and it is rubbish, but it's if it's not harmful rubbish, then you just go, all right, they're paying me to do this, I'll try to do the best I can with it.
I mean, a type designer almost has no control of what...
Oh, the type designer has no control over what the typeface will be used for.
Exactly.
And the graphic designer, publication designer, has only some control. Has the control over what the typeface will be. Actually, that's not always true. All too often, you have a client that insists on a typeface, or editors that start dictating typographic things that should be typographic decisions but are seen as editorial decisions. And so these statements that we all make about how things are divided up are not always the way it works in practice.
Have you ever aspired to be a type designer yourself?
Not really. I've thought about it many times. But I don't draw that well. On the other hand, that isn't necessarily how you do it. Probably not. I think the closest I would come was perhaps art directing a typeface. I could imagine doing that, though I don't see any reason why I particularly would. Mm-hmm. But I'd be surprised if I ever create a typeface. I might surprise myself.
What do you think about Massimo Vignelli's statement about the five basic typefaces that everybody needs and trash the rest?
Well, several things. I am in sympathy with his basic feeling, yes. Get a few good things and use them well. I have never liked his list of typefaces. I also realized, listening to him yesterday, particularly realized that he's arguing against a 20-year-old trend. I was very aware that he's essentially still, in his expressions, I don't think he is in his life, obviously, but when he's talking about typography, he tends to still be arguing with the 1980s. And it was quite a reasonable argument in the 1980s as a counter to the kind of, to David Carson in the other extreme. But it's not quite applicable today, as a couple of people pointed out in the question section of his talk. There have been some of the problems with the typefaces, with past typefaces, have been dealt with, have been fixed. Personally, I find I would rather use a typeface designed for this technology, usually a very old style in spirit typeface, I'm thinking text faces particularly here, but designed for the new technology and not an adaptation. And the typefaces on his list are all ones that have been adapted from foundry metal in most cases to hot metal to phototype to digital, to one version of digital to later versions of digital, and they've suffered all the way along the way, even Helvetica. But when Vignelli says Garamond is one of the six typefaces, I go, yes, but which Garamond? There are many typefaces with the name Garamond, and a couple that are don't have the name Garamond that are actually closer to Claude Garamond's designs than some of the ones that do have it. The extreme case, of course, is ITC Garamond, which I wish they had simply named something else. It's a very useful type advertising face and brochure face and so on. It's not a book face. Should never be confused with anything called Garamond, I mean, any other real Garamonds. But on his slide, I actually couldn't see enough to identify precisely which version of Garamond he was using there. But he was showing in the alphabet and lining figures. Well, of course, Claude Garamond never designed any lining figures. There were none. So Vignelli is making a larger point and makes that very well. But you can't take it as a detailed prescription because there's too much left out. And frankly, I'm glad to hear him say, now I would add universe. I wish he would put universe in and take Helvetica out, because although Helvetica can be used very well, and of course Vignelli has used it very well himself, it's used very badly by 99% of the people in the world, and they all have either it or now Ariel. What is most destructive, most harmful, is people who use it for business cards and letterheads and all kinds of information design, because Helvetica's numerals are very hard to tell apart. It's the exact wrong typeface to use if you have numbers, and yet it's used all the time.
And how do you feel about Alan Lupton's statement of having a sort of pool of free fonts?
Interesting. I don't... It would be a grand statement and probably a very good thing to do culturally. I had to leave just before the end of her talk, so I didn't hear the conclusion or whether there was a response. I'm sure the various type foundries would all go, what a lovely idea. No, I don't think we'll do that. But maybe not. Maybe they will. It's an idealistic concept and very interesting in that way. In a way, that's what Microsoft did when it commissioned Matthew Carter to design Georgia and Verdana, and then they gave it away to everybody. Now you can no longer download it free from their site, but it's easy to get them. They gave them away for ages. And those were designed for reading on screen, of course, but I think they work quite well in print. They're not my first choice for most print things, although Georgia, sometimes. But they're very nicely designed typefaces for what they need to do, and they were given away. Only Microsoft could afford to do that. That may be the actual practical answer to Ellen's suggestion, is only Microsoft could afford to do that. Even Adobe, I suspect, would not. But I don't know. I haven't heard the responses.
Last question. What do you think is more powerful, the written word or the spoken word?
Interesting question. And it probably... It's a question in flux today. Traditionally, the written word, probably, because it lasts longer. But, of course, printed paper or even carved stone is perishable. It's amazing sometimes that anything survives. But the other thing is that for the last century or so, we've had recorded sound. In many ways, the 20th century was the century of recorded sound. It changed everything about our lives. You know, the fact that we're doing this now could not have happened 150 years ago, we would not have a personal soundtrack plugged into our ears, or even put into a cylinder phonograph in the 20s. So technology or media really determine what will survive and how long of the sounds that we make, but potentially the spoken word can go on forever. So I don't know, that changes it a bit. Obviously the spoken word has more immediate effect, in a geographically immediate effect. You can rouse a crowd of people and turn them into a mob, for instance. Hard to do that with a printed word. On the other hand, with the printed or at least written word, in text messages or online, you can create flash mobs halfway around the world. So, yeah, it's very hard to say. They go together. And it's been said before that what we've been doing for a long time as a species is extending our nervous systems. Everything we do with speech in the original sense, at the very beginning, speech and then written words of any kind sort of go beyond what our bodies do and extend what we can perceive and what we can put out. Obviously, every kind of recorded information, everything that gives us today vision of something that's going on somewhere at a distance, or audio, radio, television, the fact that we can go on the internet and look at, you know, photos that are a few hours old from a moon of Saturn is extending our nervous system and our perceptions way beyond, you know, the reach of my hands here. So that's the context for the future answer to that question.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure.
www.typeradio.org. All Type Radio interviews and podcasts may be downloaded for personal use only and may not be used in any other way by third parties except with prior written consent from Type Radio.